Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joshua Rubenstein of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's report to the UN, asserting that the U.S. continues to subject detainees to torture and abuse. Retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who talks about his recent public confrontation with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and assesses the change in leadership at the CIA. And Ibrahim Ramsey of the Climate Crisis Coalition, who explains the connections he sees between opposition to the Iraq War and the broader struggle to protect the environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
France and Chile have embarked on a new initiative to raise funds to provide medicines for HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and other diseases to poor nations by imposing a direct tax on airline tickets that will raise millions of dollars. According to the Interpress service, the tax is the first independent funding scheme implemented to meet the United Nations mandated Millennium Development Goals. The MDGs, as they are known, are targeted to cut extreme poverty and hunger in half, provide universal primary education, reduce the rate of child mortality, and promote environmental sustainability, all by 2015. The new ticket tax is expected to raise $300 million in France and $6 million in Chile. Yet it is only a small down payment on meeting the MDGs, which could require $50 billion a year in new international funding. In addition, Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva pledged $12 million in solidarity funds to meet the MDGs and may also institute the tax on airline tickets. Advocates of global justice have long sought a Tobin tax on foreign currency exchange transactions that was first proposed by American economist James Tobin in 1972. Advocates say a small tax on currency transfers could raise $15 billion a year for international programs. Currently, wealthy countries, with a few exceptions like Denmark and Sweden, have failed to meet a 30-year promise to dedicate 0.7% of their economies to aid developing nations. Every night, teams of gunmen roam the streets of the poorest neighborhoods in Guatemala and seize people suspected of wrongdoing. In the morning, corpses are found left behind, usually with signs of torture or strangulation. According to the Washington Post, over 400 people were killed in suspected murders in the first 2 months of 2006 in a violent campaign of social cleansing. In 2005, nearly 3,000 murders took place. The victims were mostly petty thieves or tattooed members of street gangs. So far, the police have arrested few people for these vigilante killings, although in February, police arrested 7 armed men in olive uniforms and black masks who were suspected of committing a dozen murders, as well as shaking down tourists for protection money. Violence seems to be on the rise since the 1996 peace accords that ended the country's 36-year civil war, during which more than 200,000 civilians were killed, mostly at the hands of government-run death squads. Mario Polanco, head of the victim rights organization Mutual Support Group in Guatemala City, observed the armed groups have become so accustomed to killing on their own accord that when they have personal enemies, they'll kill that person too, and the country becomes more and more violent. Y-12, the nuclear bomb-making plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that enriched the uranium for the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, is still in business. But its 6,000 workers have had little to do for 15 years. To keep the factory going, Congress spends $300 million a year to transfer the facility's store of radioactive metal to a new secure site. Y-12 also tests components of existing nuclear weapons to ensure they still work. 1992 was the last year the U.S. government tested a nuclear weapon. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, the National Nuclear Security Administration has a $9 billion annual budget to operate the U.S. nuclear weapons complex, a system of 8 plants that are now obsolete and an open target for terrorists. Last summer, a congressionally mandated report called for the consolidation of the nuclear weapons complex to save billions of dollars and improve security. But the report was rejected by the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, who has 2 nuclear labs in his district. In a statement, Domenici declared, "I don't think we need to rush into any quick fixes." In the end, Congress only approved $5 million for fiscal year 2006 to study a plan for the consolidation of the aging nuclear weapons complex. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
report issued by Amnesty International on May 3rd asserts that torture and other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment of detainees by U.S. forces is widespread and in many cases sanctioned by high-level government officials. The 32,000-word report was released prior to the beginning of hearings in Geneva on U.S. compliance with the UN Convention Against Torture. Amnesty says that evidence continues to emerge that prisoners held by the U.S. are subjected to torture in American-run facilities in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba, Iraq, and other locations. The report goes on to say that there is clear evidence that much of the physical and psychological ill-treatment has stemmed directly from officially sanctioned procedures and policies, including interrogation techniques approved by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld for use in Guantanamo and later exported to Iraq. At least 34 detainees who died in U.S. custody have been classified by the Pentagon as suspected homicides. But Amnesty believes that the number may well be higher due to cover-ups. Britain's Attorney General Lord Goldsmith has recently joined Amnesty and other human rights groups in calling for the closure of America's Guantanamo Cuba Detention Center. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's report on U.S. torture.
The U.S. is a signatory to the Convention Against Torture, and all the signatories, there are well over 120, are obliged on a periodic basis to appear before the committee to answer questions. And often this may be a routine thing, or there are some minor matters that have to be raised. I think it's a good component of accountability under the convention. But, of course, in recent years, there are serious reports and allegations of mistreatment and torture by U.S. forces in Iraq, and we all know what happened at Abu Ghraib, in Afghanistan, and in Guantanamo. So Amnesty, on the eve of the U.S. appearance before the committee, which actually happened last week, we issued about a 50-page report summarizing all we've learned in the last few years about this really a pattern of torture. We wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee so it would have it on hand when it questioned U.S. officials.
What kind of documentation has Amnesty International done on the continuing conditions in which detainees are being held?
Well, everyone is familiar with the fact that 2 years ago now, the scandal broke at Abu Ghraib, and the administration had to own up to the fact that there were these incidents. But, of course, the administration wants to say that there are always bad apples and that they are holding people accountable. Of course, for the most part, only lower-down officers, not high-ranking officials. But how can you separate the memos that circulated in Washington, in the White House Counsel's Office, in the Department of Justice, in the Pentagon, where they recommended harsh treatment and torture, where they said and they tried to limit the definition of torture so that the interrogation techniques they wanted to use would not be defined as torture as they saw fit? We believe there's a consistent pattern between what Washington was advocating and what soldiers and officers in Guantanamo, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan were actually doing, that you can't dismiss these incidents as an aberration.
Now, what do you hope to accomplish with this report that documents these conditions?
Look, a lot of this news has, of course, been in our national magazines. It's in our newspapers. It's not a secret anymore. Congress has discussed it and tried to explore it, but really in a very limited way because Congress does not wish to hold the White House accountable. The Republicans control both houses of Congress, and frankly, they're not living up to their constitutional obligation to hold the White House accountable. So it's up to human rights organizations like Amnesty International to collect this information, to interview lawyers, to interview detainees when they're released, to get their hands on government documents. And a lot of government documents have been released that have confirmed our worst fears. After all, the ACLU has done a wonderful job under the Freedom of Information Act to get documents out of the government, and this is all confirmed to our satisfaction that this is not an aberrant act of irresponsible or immature individuals, but in fact is a consistent pattern of abuse that reflects government policy. And that's what we want the UN to explore.
Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the chain of command and where the responsibility lies in terms of these policies that have allowed or encouraged this kind of treatment of prisoners.
Look, we have a document over Mr. Rumsfeld's signature where he calls for various forms of very harsh interrogations, including sleep deprivation, manipulation of the environment, meaning making things hot, making things cold, holding prisoners naked, holding them in stress positions. There's no question that Rumsfeld was trying to have it both ways, trying to say we're not going to use torture, but we're going to use interrogation techniques that obviously will lead officers over the line. Secondly, we know that General Miller in Guantanamo was transferred from Guantanamo to Iraq, and the word is he was told to gitmoize Abu Ghraib, to gitmoize Iraq, to use the techniques that he had employed at Guantanamo and then expand on them in Iraq. And then when General Miller was initially called to testify at a hearing or a trial, he said he would invoke the Fifth Amendment. Now, would he do that if the techniques he had been advocating, he had been insisting on using, crossed the line into torture and mistreatment? Of course not. That's a common sense question. So it seems to us there's more than adequate evidence, not just allegations, but really evidence, that what was going on in Abu Ghraib, that what was uncovered at Abu Ghraib 2 years ago, shows a consistent pattern of government policy. And that's what we need to, where we need to hold this government accountable.
Now, it's unlikely that the United Nations has any influence or power to hold our elected officials accountable for the abuse and torture in U.S. facilities. But what is Congress doing? Maybe you can make a comment on the congressional ban that was recently signed into law on torture. However, George W. Bush, as he's done in the Boston Globe, documented these some 700 signing statements, which really provide some kind of loophole, I guess, in the minds of the backers of the unitary executive theory or philosophy that he doesn't really have to comply with congressional law. But tell us a little bit about that.
What you cited is very worrisome. The president has issued these hundreds of signing statements, in particular after he signed the McCain Amendment, which forbade the use of torture and said that all U.S. interrogations have to take place in a way that are consistent with the field manual of our soldiers, which prohibits torture. The president said, sure, I'll sign it, but if I feel it's necessary not to abide by this law, I'll just order people not to abide by it. So he's simply saying that when he chooses to, he's above the law, which is outrageous. And I think shows that the president and his people are not speaking in good faith when they say that they do not support the use of torture, they prohibit the use of torture, they will prosecute people who are caught mistreating prisoners. But they can't say that on the one hand and be taken seriously when the president issues this signing statement, which more or less says, I am above the law.
And that was Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 212-807-8400 or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
we
said,
were just.
You said you knew where they were near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
Something unusual happened in Atlanta, Georgia, on May 4th. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was confronted with tough questions about the U.S. war in Iraq. The questioner was Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA analyst who had himself been in charge of the president's daily brief during the 1980s. In his now-famous exchange with Rumsfeld, McGovern demanded to know why the defense secretary had lied about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and links to al-Qaeda, the Bush administration's long-disproven rationales for the war. Meanwhile, turmoil at the CIA was evident when Porter Goss abruptly resigned as CIA director and President Bush promptly nominated a successor, General Michael Hayden. Hayden, Deputy Director of National Intelligence and former Director of the National Security Agency, quickly came under fire from both Democrats and Republicans for his ties to the Pentagon and his direct involvement in carrying out President Bush's order to perform warrantless surveillance of American citizens, an action many observers maintain violates the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. There is speculation that Goss's resignation could be linked to a bribery scandal involving convicted Republican Congressman Duke Cunningham, defense contractors, poker games, and prostitutes. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Ray McGovern about his encounter with Donald Rumsfeld and his assessment of the changes in leadership at the CIA.
Thank you for asking those tough questions, Ray.
Well, they're questions that need to be asked, and if our domesticated press won't dare to ask them, I guess it falls to us to do so.
Well, you had a powerful presentation. You didn't get to say a lot, but the questions you did ask that were broadcast nationally penetrated the kind of phony credibility that the White House has seemed to have in the press, as you said, for all these years here.
You know, what was unnerving was the reaction of the folks there. Now, I've seen a lot of films of the 30s in Germany, and actually I've lived in Germany for 5 years, and it was scary. You know, these folks began by being told by the president of this center that Rumsfeld was not only really smart, but he was honest. And I said to myself, gosh, you know, it is a little unusual introducing somebody, say, hey, he's a smart guy, but he's also honest, you know. And then at every turn, for example, when he said, I did not lie, they just, you know, cheered, you know. There was no sense that these folks were open to the possibility that I had an intelligent question to ask, and that it wasn't really an attack on the defense secretary, but as a request for clarification.
What do you make of CIA Director Porter Goss's resignation and President Bush's choice to replace him, General Michael Hayden?
It's very bizarre. You'll recall Goss telling the press, this is mysterious, and it's going to remain so. So I don't know. I mean, he clearly was doing a miserable job. I mean, it was a catastrophe from the word go. He was tired. He complained about the burden of work at the agency. He wasn't able, as he was in Congress, to go home on Thursday noon and come back on Tuesday noon, to back and forth to Florida. And he managed to incur the wrath of just about everybody in the agency, and it debilitated even still more. So whether it was simply that finally Negroponte and the president were wise to the fact that he was destroying what's left of our intelligence capability, or perhaps he was involved in this Dusty Frago thing, the fellow who was close to the defense contractor that got Duke Cunningham in trouble. I don't think anybody did anything than applaud when he agreed to leave, and so that's for Goss. He's a good riddance, in my view. Now, Hayden. Hayden is a uniformed officer in the United States Air Force. I was a uniformed officer in the U.S. Army. We, each of us, swore an oath to defend, protect the Constitution of the United States. Each of us had it drilled into us that it was against the ethic of commissioned officers to obey an illegal order. Here's Hayden, goes up to NSA, well-liked, respected, sort of a favorite up there, you know. Why? Well, because he drummed into each and every worker the 11th commandment at NSA, which is, thou shalt not monitor Americans. Now, the people at NSA were aghast when they heard of his role in this unauthorized, illegal monitoring program. How did that happen? Well, after 9/11, as the saying goes, you've heard it 100 times, after 9/11, everything changed. And Cheney went to Hayden, or called Hayden to his office and said, now we're going to take the gloves off on electronic intercepting. No one knew better than Hayden that this was against the law, pure and simple. But he didn't have the courage of his conviction to say, Mr. Vice President, with all due respect, I'm not obliged to obey an illegal order. I believe this is such, and so I can resign, or you can give me a new job, but I'm not going to do this. Instead of that, and this is the insidious part here, Hayden, for whatever reason, decided to go back on his oath to defend the Constitution, on his ethos that he drummed into his workers at NSA, and he said, yes, sir, whatever, you know, count me in. I can do this, sure, you know. Now, is that the kind of guy? Is that what we want running the CIA? I mean, when Negroponte and the president say he's exquisitely qualified to be the new head of the CIA, well, from their point of view, of course he is, because he'll do whatever they tell him, whether it's lawful or not. And with the record of the CIA in recent months, torture, kidnappings, keeping people in detention, incommunicado, and various other indignities, do we want somebody that's simply going to do what the president tells him, whether it's legal or not, or are we going to do what we should do with General Hayden? And I had a very, very high-ranking general tell me when all this broke, he said, Ray, Hayden should be court-martialed. And I believe that's the case. He should be court-martialed rather than nominated to be head of the CIA.
That was 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who, until his retirement in 1990, led one of two CIA teams conducting the most secret daily intelligence briefings at the White House. Read McGovern's articles online at www.truthout.org. For what was probably the first time, an environmental coalition was a key organizing element in a mobilization that was primarily focused on opposition to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. The April 29th anti-war march in New York City focused on demands that the U.S. end the war in Iraq and preventing a new military confrontation with Iran. But the march, which attracted some 350,000 protesters, also demanded that the government respond to the needs of survivors of Hurricane Katrina and address global warming. The Climate Crisis Coalition, one of nine groups that initiated the march, is a network of 70 environmental, peace, justice, and labor organizations that supports an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. At a press conference preceding the New York City march, Ibrahim Raimi, a member of the Climate Crisis Coalition Steering Committee, said, "We bring to this movement the understanding that ending the war against the environment must also be a central element in our broad work for peace and justice." The coalition raised the connections between wars for oil, the lack of homeland security where hurricane victims are concerned, and the changes wrought by global warming. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus caught up with Raimi after the march, where she spoke with him about the interconnection of these issues and the coalition's agenda for change.
We see the climate issue and the global warming issue as being an integral part of the effort to stop war, to stop resource wars, and to create sustainable economics and sustainable energy.
Does the Climate Crisis Coalition think that in order to move on with any of your long-term goals, you have to stop the war first? Or how do you see the next year unfolding, or 5 years?
Well, I see us as being part of a very broad, united front of civil society that is demanding peace, demanding justice, and fundamentally demanding a shift in the use of resources for creating sustainable economics and ultimately saving the Earth. We think that the consumption of oil is an integral part of global warming, which, of course, is one of the things and the central thing that we are concerned with. But we also recognize that there can be no real peace and no justice without a sustainable future for all of us. And that means that in every aspect of the peace movement, the anti-war movement, the movement for social justice, that we integrate into those movements a recognition of the climate crisis and a need for direct action to stop it.
In my long experience going to anti-war marches, this is the first one I've seen that had right up as one of the top demands about, you know, any kind of environmental issue, really.
My observation is exactly that, too, that this is the first of the seven or eight major mobilizations, I guess, from 2002, you know, before the 2003 U.S. invasion, until now, that the issue of climate crisis and the issue of stopping war were definitely on the same page. I have to also tell you that Katrina, the hurricane that devastated New Orleans last September, has been a wake-up call for many people, not in terms of just the irresponsible diversion of resources from the people of New Orleans, but also as we saw today, or actually this week, in a news release, that climatologists and people who study the climate situation are in agreement that major hurricanes and superstorms like Katrina are in fact due to climate shifts that are at the core of the crisis that we're looking at in a planetary way. So Katrina, resources for rebuilding New Orleans, stopping the war in Iraq, and stopping global warming are all part of a basket of issues that a united front has to demand change in and also press forward to a political conclusion, hopefully, in the midterm elections this year, and we would hope in 2008 as well.
Do you put a lot of energy into electoral politics and into this year's elections, congressional elections?
Well, what the CCC is planning to do is to develop a platform of environmental responsible actions and legislations that we're putting forward so that in congressional races all over the United States, candidates from all the parties recognize that there are citizens' demands for legislation that, for example, will divert resources from subsidizing oil and use it for research and development to make solar energy and geothermal and wind energy, for example, much more available at a lower cost to people. The ultimate survival of the species depends upon breaking from an oil-driven economy and breaking from a war system that's based on oil, and making those major transitions to a sustainable economy, a sustainable environment, and ultimately a sustainable planet for all of us.
I noticed you didn't mention nuclear power.
Well, my position on nuclear power is that nuclear power is another big, big negative. Our focus right now is not so much on nuclear power, however, as it is on sustainable energy, but I would certainly agree that nuclear power and the danger of the waste cycle, the danger of another Chernobyl kind of incident, is very much part of a broad basket of issues that we have to address. I think that the technology to create sustainable energy is here. It needs some refinement. For example, General Motors is claiming that they can come up with a production fuel cell car by the year 2010. That's only 4 years away. Other manufacturers like Honda, for example, have really taken the lead in creating fuel cell technology that would only pump water vapor into the air as opposed to carbon pollutants. So my sense is that what is required is a shift in the focus of research and development on one hand to put money into technologies that are non-polluting and renewable, and on the other hand to take money away from the subsidies that the auto industry and big oil and big coal get.
That was Ibrahim Raimi of the Climate Crisis Coalition. Call the group at area code 413-243-5665 or visit their website at www.climatecrisiscoalition.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.